This is a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 1 91 FM, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Kia ora, morena koutou and haere mai. My name is Nico.
And I'm Amelia.
And you are listening to your 11 a.m. weekly R1 Ratu Tuesday news show here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Coming up on the program, I Tēnei Rā, we speak to politics professor Janine Hayward for the first instalment of our new segment looking into local body politics. Elections for 2022 are happening this October, so today we're going to be hearing about how local government works as well as the electoral system. After that, we'll be speaking to Leon Sturck Wang, Otago Economics PhD student, on the government's decision to fully reopen borders to tourists. And then we'll be speaking to Mayor Aaron Hawkins about being banned from entering Russia. Finally, to end the show, we'll be diving into what happened on this day in history and hear some fun facts of events which have happened on the 2nd of August in previous years.
But before all of that, we will be joined by Dave, who will be doing the news headlines and weather.
The R1 News headlines. The R1 News weather.
Thank you.
I've got my own little magic, and I'm not trying to wreak havoc. It's just that sometimes I see something and I just need a high.
That was Alice Phoebe Lou with Witches, and before that it was Marlon Williams with My Boy. We are now going to be moving into our news and headlines for this morning. Dave will be reading these.
The R1 News Headlines.
Tēnā koutou, ko Dave aho. Aotearoa's borders have completely reopened as the remainder of travel restrictions have been lifted. After borders abruptly shut in March 2020, Jacinda Ardern has said that Aotearoa is open for business, as visitors from all over the world will be allowed to enter the country. Tourism Minister Stuart Nash said that the return of cruise ships would be a boost for local businesses. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, tourism was Aotearoa's largest export industry. Over 2 million New Zealanders received the first instalment of the cost of living payment yesterday. The first of $116 was paid to those over 18 who earn less than $70,000 annually and do not receive a benefit or winter energy payment. Concerns have been raised by the opposition that the payment might have gone to some who are not eligible for it after some expats living overseas reported receiving it. Revenue Minister David Parker says of the 2.1 million who received the payment, 1% are thought to have received it incorrectly. IRD functions on an automated system which could not necessarily identify whether otherwise eligible New Zealanders are based overseas. The cost of living payment seeks to alleviate some of the burden of inflation on New Zealanders as it reaches its highest level since 1990. The US claims to have killed Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in Kabul via drone strike as part of a counter-terrorism operation in Afghanistan. While no independent confirmation has been released, President Joe Biden is set to provide detail in the coming hours. The US claims the operation took place over the weekend and that there are no civilian casualties. And those were the headlines on R1 News. Now, kei te pēhea te ahua o Tarangi. How's the weather?
The R1 News weather.
Otipoti is springy today. A high of 16 is accompanied by northwesterlies gusting up to 100 kilometres in exposed places. Apōpō expect a high of 14 and clear, sunny skies.
That was the R1 News headlines. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram and tune in to R1 News at 11 a.m. on weekdays.
Kia ora for those headlines, Dave. Coming up next on the program, we're going to be speaking with Professor Janine Haywood about local body politics. But first, here's a song. This is Tail Whip by Men I Trust. You're listening to R1 News on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. That was Men I Trust by Tail Whip. It is 11:15 and you're listening to R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. And it is now time for our new segment looking into local body politics. 2022 local body elections are happening this October, and over the next 9 weeks, we're going to be exploring the ins and outs of local politics here on the Tuesday R1 News show. For our first instalment, we're going to break down the background to this election. Professor Janine Hayward from the University of Otago Department of Politics is joining us now to talk about the local electoral system and how local government works. Kia ora, Janine.
Kia ora.
How's it going?
Good, thank you. Thanks for the invitation. I am delighted that you are running this segment for the next 9 weeks.
Thanks for coming on. So to start off with, we're going to give you such a basic question. Can you just tell us what local government actually is?
Sure. So local government, there are across the country 1,600 different people who get elected to help run politics at a more local level than central government does. So it would be a bad idea to make central government, put central government in charge of decisions that are quite particular to regions and particularly to cities. So instead we have a second layer of government, local government, and we elect people to that to help us out with some of that decision making.
So what are some things that are actually the responsibility of central government but people expect local governments to be able to change and get confused about when it comes to voting?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think one of the main things is roads. So people get quite upset. There is a difference about who controls and is responsible for which type of roads. So central government controls all of our state, you know, the big roading, but it's our regional councils that control the roading within our communities. And, you know, bizarrely, that's one of the things that people quite often misunderstand, and they'll make a complaint about central government not doing this or the regional council not doing that, not understanding whose job it is.
Right. And so on the flip side, what are some things that are surprisingly in the control of local governments and not central?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the really interesting debates. Local government would like to be in control of a lot more than it is. Because, you know, one of their arguments is that they know their communities well and they're far more responsive to the challenges that local communities face. And I think climate change is a really good example of that. So there are a lot of issues going on in communities with trying to future-proof some of our, you know, different areas of housing. And local governments are currently a little bit limited in what they can do because a lot of the decision-making still has to come from central government. So there's a lot of politics around the separation of power. Basically, local government can only do what central government has told it can, and it can just as easily whip that power away if it chooses to. And we've seen that played out recently with the Three Waters. So central government has decided to change the way that the water infrastructure is managed, and that's caused huge debates because local governments don't want, you know, a lot of them don't want to relinquish that power, and central government's arguing that it can do a better job if that's centralised and operated differently and funded resource differently as well. So there's heaps of politics involved, not surprisingly, in that separation of powers.
Right, and there are also further layers between the separation of local and central government. Could you explain the difference between city, regional and district councils?
Yeah, sure. So there's basically, there's kind of two main differences. So there's regional councils, And, you know, an example of that is the Otago Regional Council. So we've got 11 regional councils across New Zealand, and they basically do all the big-scale resource stuff. So they're in charge of land management in their areas, pest control, flood control, transport, as I said before, and harbours. And those are really big. Like, the Otago Regional Council is a massive area. And then you have at a next level down, you know, slightly smaller areas and more of them, you've got what are either called district or city councils, kind of the same thing, but ones that are involved, incorporate a city, like Dunedin City Council, are called city councils. So there's 11 of those, and there are 50 of these district councils that sort of cover a whole bunch of little towns in an area. So the role of those, that other layer of government, those city and district councils, is more about people than it is about major resources. So they do a lot of the civil defence stuff. They do a lot of our building controls, so some of the resource things. They're about planning for how we use our land. They've got a 10-year plan to talk about what our areas are going to look like. They do a lot of the environmental safety and health infrastructure, water at the moment, sewage, stormwater and that kind of stuff. So we often see and engage with, you know, both of those layers, but often the people side of it is more that city council, which is probably why we hear more about our Dunedin City Council in news and its decisions than we do the regional council.
Mm-hmm. And so who can vote for those different councils, and what are we actually voting for when we do?
So if you can vote in general elections, so if you're a registered New Zealand voter, if you're older than 18, if you've lived in New Zealand for more than a year continuously and are a citizen or a permanent resident, you can vote in your local elections as well. So weirdly, there still seems to be a bit of a myth that local governments are for ratepayers. So I know a lot of young people think, well, I don't own a home, I don't pay rates, so it doesn't really matter to me. It absolutely does. So if you're a voter, you can vote in the local government elections coming up. And where you're registered to vote will determine which of those elections you vote in. So if you've changed your address details on the elections website to Dunedin, you can vote in the Dunedin City Council elections, and you absolutely should. So we know when we talk to student voters, they often feel they're just here sort of transitioning through Dunedin. They're only here for a few years, and they don't really want to bind other students to their preference of councillor. You know, my message would be, go right ahead. I mean, you're speaking for a very large constituency in Dunedin. It's, you know, upwards of 20,000 voters, a big proportion of the population, and not very good at voting in local government. So if you change your address details, you can vote here if you fit all the other criteria, and you absolutely should.
Cool. So a bit more specifically about the method of voting, the Dunedin City uses a single transferable voting system. Could you tell us a bit about how that works and how it's different from the first-past-the-post system, which is used for the Otago Regional Council?
Sure. So before the early 2000s, all local government used the first-past-the-post electoral system. So that's the system that we use when we vote for our electorate MPs, where you simply, you know, tick who you want to support and the person with the most votes wins. Now, when you're voting for one person, that kind of works reasonably well, although you can still have someone with a minority win. But, it you know, we kind of live with that. In local government elections, we often are voting for multiple candidates in a ward, which is like a little electorate. And when you do that with first past the post, it's not a very it's a very bad way of electing people, in the sense that what the community actually wants doesn't get translated well into who gets elected. So we know when we look at what happens with first past the post voting that it's probably one of the worst systems you could use for local government elections like we have. So what the government did in early 2000 was introduce an option for governments to use a proportional system instead, which is called STV. And it was designed specifically to overcome the problems that first past the post creates in voting in those kinds of elections. So you basically, with STV, you're only voting once, but you rank the candidates that you like. So I won't get into the details of how it works, but it basically means that when you look at the way people voted and you look at who gets elected, it's a pretty close reflection of what people's preferences were. So we know that in first-past-the-post elections, the vast majority of voters can sometimes not help to elect anyone and disagree with who got elected. That doesn't happen under STV. So generally speaking, you start to find that the councils will better reflect whoever it was, the diversity of people standing for election, because the proportionality of that system helps to ensure that it reflects the way people voted. So it's a good thing that Dunedin uses STV, and it's a pity, frankly, that the Otago Regional Council still hasn't made that change.
Right, yeah, so has it been a slow transition across the country for people councils moving to STV?
Yes, it has, and particularly because, you know, unwisely, I think, the government left it to councils to decide that for themselves. And, you know, elected representatives aren't famous for changing the way that they got voted in case it doesn't work for them next time. So, you know, we know that elected representatives usually don't change their electoral systems, and we've seen that. So councils have tended to stick with the status quo unless their communities have forced them to change by a poll, or they have, in many cases also, decided to make this change because they're under increasing pressure from their communities to do that. So what we've seen is, I mean, the number of councils using STV still isn't huge. There's probably maybe a dozen, 15 of them this election, but it's some of the really big councils. So Hamilton and Tauranga have changed, Nelson's changed, Palmerston North's changed. So we're seeing some of those large councils changing. So the number of people voting using STV is increasing each election, even if there's still an awful lot of councils that are still using first past the post.
Mm-hmm. And looking at elections more generally, why is it that voter turnout is so much lower for local government than central government elections?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we struggle with voter turnout even in central government elections now, national elections, and we know that what increases turnout is when elections are really high profile, when there's a really big issue at stake, when there's heaps of media coverage, when there's a real kind of clash of maybe people or opinions on a particular issue, and when the choices are pretty obvious for voters and it's not a huge effort for them to think about it. So if you think about all of those ingredients, not many of them are true of local government elections. So, you know, October 8th is going to roll around when we'll be voting in these elections. We will talk generally about there being local government elections, but there's not really national coverage of those elections, if you get what I mean, because they're all different races. So one of the highest turnouts we ever got was when the Auckland Council had just been created, and we heard so much about it in the news that people were aware of the fact that there was a election coming up, and it boosted turnout. So for local elections, we really rely on local news media to do what they can to raise the profile of the election, and you hope that there is something going on, like an issue in a community or a personality that kind of catches people's attention, that can really draw attention to the fact that this event is coming up and that people you know, are motivated to engage in it and feel like they can make a difference by casting their vote. And I guess the other thing that sometimes voters say they find more challenging about local elections is that parties aren't involved. So you've really got to try and work out what all these individual people are standing for. And often when you read the blurbs about them in the candidate booklet, they talk about how much they love the region and how they've grown up here and how many cats they've got, which isn't terribly helpful in terms of trying to anticipate what kinds of decisions they're going to make. So all of those things mean that it's harder for voters to get engaged. But having said that, we've still got pretty good turnout compared to other countries for local elections, and I think, you know, this increasing effort being made and engagement by younger people because of some of the challenges that are coming up, you know, coming back to climate change. Some of these are obviously challenges we're going to confront, and local government obviously has a role to play, and that's kind of increasing our interest and attention on some of those issues.
Right. So my last question this morning is, in your view, what are some of the key things to be aware of while engaging in local politics, and what should we be looking for before voting this October?
Well, you know, I hope that some candidates will run who are clearly trying to represent the student community in Dunedin, because we've never really had a great deal of that in Dunedin. And there are an awful lot of issues in this city that we should be thinking about and engaging with in terms of the connection between the university and the council and student life and, you know, the rest of the city. And using STV, you only need about 6,000 votes to support you out of 100,000. And the student community is really big. It's about 20,000, potentially, 20,000 voters. So we could easily see a couple of really good candidates who have campaigned on the basis of taking a student or university voice to council, which would be tremendous. Other than that, I think it's just really important to ask all of the candidates, get them on campus, ask them what their views are on particular issues that are of concern to students and to that generation. And, you know, it's just that good old-fashioned accountability to listen to what they're going to say and make your choices based on what you hear them talk about when they're campaigning.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. And I hope the rest of the segment goes well, and I hope it encourages heaps of people to get out and vote.
Thank you. That was Otago Politics Professor Janine Haywood telling us a little bit about local government, how it works, and how to get involved with the elections happening this October on October 8th. Up next, we're going to be joined by Otago Economics PhD student to talk about reopening the borders to all tourists and the impact this will have on the economy and infrastructure. But first, this is Witty Donna with No Follow Through. You're listening to R1 News on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Thank you.
Kia ora, you're tuned into R1 News. It is currently 35 minutes past 11. That was Wiridona with No Follow Through, and we are moving into our second live interview for the show. From yesterday, all tourists have been welcomed back into New Zealand. The borders are fully reopened as per the government's decision. This might be the best shot at the country's economic way of getting out of a potential recession, but there are concerns that the tourism's recovery will be slow, as the tourism sector could struggle to meet the lift in demand given the lack of available workers. To get more of an idea on this current situation and whether or not this influx of tourists will bring desired results of bettering the economy, I'm about to be joined live on air with Leon Sturck-Wayne, Otago Economics PhD student, to discuss the government's decision. Kia ora, Leon. Are you there?
Hi, how's it going?
Hi, good, thank you. How are you?
Good. It's nice to be here, spiritually, if not physically.
Well, just to start off with this influx of tourists who are now being able to enter the border, do you reckon that they will bring the desired results of getting out of and avoiding a recession for the economy?
Look, the short answer is no. I'm a little bit less optimistic than what maybe you sound like. The first thing, of course, to remember is that this is an incremental policy, right? So it's just the last stage in sort of slowly increasing the degree of openness of the borders. So my understanding is that, of course, this is just lifting the restrictions on non-visa waiver countries. So that's the first thing, as it's just the sort of last kind of increase in the last lifting of the restrictions on the sort of last group of people who were previously restricted. So, so it's a sort of incremental thing. The other thing, I guess, is whether it produces a large uptick in economic activity. Now, it's probably fairly uncontroversial to say that there will be an increase in the amount of economic activity, that is, tourist spending that happens. But I'm not hugely optimistic that it will be enough to necessarily stave off recession, mostly because whether or not we, the sort of overall health of the economy sort of depends in the current instance more on what's going on sort of globally rather than how many tourists we can attract.
Definitely. And regarding that, which is good to know, I guess, because I don't know too much about the situation, Do you think that there is enough infrastructure in place to then take on these new arrivals, these new tourists in this final step, as you said, of opening the border? Or will it, in fact, maybe stretch like health systems and like accommodating strategies?
Yeah, okay. So so this was interesting. I mean, when you sort of asked me about infrastructure, I guess I thought about it in sort of two threads. The first thing was I can't imagine the pressure on what we traditionally think of as infrastructure as being that great for the most part, right? So pre-pandemic, we obviously had a fairly active tourism industry, and you know, the what we traditionally think of as infrastructure held up fairly well, right? So if we think about, like, you know, our roading network or, you know, transport networks in general, or, you know, like city infrastructure, like sewage networks or whatever. I mean, that's sort of traditionally what we think of as infrastructure. And I can't imagine that those sorts of things are going to struggle, given that, you know, we haven't been ripping up roads or anything. The only thing that I could think of was maybe the effect on the sort of healthcare infrastructure that we have in place. And the reason I thought that was, you know, an open border and less restrictive sort of deal with, in terms of testing people or monitoring infection that crosses the border, means that you might have an uptick in the probability or the speed at which, you know, COVID can start moving around the community again. Not to say that there isn't enough of it here to sort of spark its own waves, but certainly, you know, importing a lot of across the border is liable to sort of, like, increase the quantity that we have. And so my read is that, like, hospitals generally are at capacity or they're sort of struggling. Mm. And so that was the only sort of, like, infrastructure issue that I could sort of think of. Which brings me to the second thing, which is your other concern, which is, like, can the tourism industry cope with an increase in demand? And to me, that is primarily, like, a labour market problem. So to hear tourism operators tell it they are having trouble finding staff, which is legitimate, and similarly, you know, the deal with the stretching of the healthcare resources is to do mainly with I guess being able to find staff to kind of provide those services, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I guess then, since you mentioned that it won't necessarily help the economy, what do you consider then to be a good approach to allow the economy to kind of increase and grow if the tourism, like, influx is not necessarily going to bring that as it has kind of been positioned, or at least hopefully positioned to bring?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I'm not saying that it's a sort of complete waste of time or anything. I mean, I do think that you know, there's some real value in terms of you know, increased tourism numbers, and it's, you know, it definitely will increase economic activity. It'll definitely fill some people's pockets. But, I just don't think that we should necessarily be expecting a return to sort of pre-pandemic levels of activity, just given the fact that the labour market's changed so dramatically, at least not in the sort of short to medium term. So what do I think is a good way to sort the economy out? Well, I mean, you know, the general position of the economists is always to just think about whether we are employing the resources that we have most effectively. That's always kind of how we're thinking. You know, no matter how much or how little we have, the only real thing we can do is make sure that we're employing the labour that we have and the capital that we have in the way that is most productive. So for sure, like, you know, there's probably a bunch of tourism-specific capital floating around, right? You know, if the Milford Sound ferries, for instance, if a bunch of them are like sort of sat idle, then increased tourist numbers means that you can put those tours back on again, and that's a productive use of that capital that would otherwise sit unused. So that's obviously pretty good. But of course, you know, there's no getting away from the fact that as we sort of adjust to a changed environment post-pandemic, you know, some operators just won't be able to sort of continue in business, right? Like, whenever we talk about labour market problems or staff shortages, this is always, it always comes back to a wage question. So if you're having trouble finding people, primarily it's an issue of having trouble finding people at the wage you want to pay them. And so the answer is typically to increase wages. And so, you know, that's for the hospitality sector and, like I was saying, the sort of healthcare sector that I was talking about before. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, if you increase wages and that means your costs are too high to make money, then the only thing you can do to stay in business is, of course, to raise your prices. And, you know, ultimately, if you raise those prices and people aren't happy to pay those prices, then that's a fairly strong signal that the business isn't profitable and you shouldn't be in business. So, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for how hard it is for some people to adjust to that. Obviously, some people lose their livelihoods, but, you know, ultimately we do have to kind of accept that if the environment's changed, then...
Yeah, it's a changing system, very different dynamics than pre-pandemic, sure. I think is what we can take away from this. But thank you so much, though, for joining us on air to discuss this, to shed light on the situation,
and
to provide a bit of info just about the nature of the economy and how it has changed over the past couple of years. So thank you very much, and thank you for joining us, Leon.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
That was Leon Sterk Wang, a PhD student in economics at the University of Otago, speaking to me about the government's decision to fully reopen borders and how it is kind of the final step of opening it up to allow tourism to get fully back into swing in New Zealand and what we can likely expect from this decision. Now we are going to have a quick song break, and then we are moving into our final live interview of the show, where we will be talking to Mayor Aaron Hawkins about him being banned from entering Russia. Stay tuned and make sure you listen to that conversation. It is 11:45. You're listening to R1 News.
Everything I wanna do, we'll be right back.
Kia ora, you are tuned into R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. We are moving into our third live interview of the show. On Sunday, the Russian Foreign Ministry published a list of 32 New Zealanders banned from entering the country. New Zealand has a number of sanctions imposed against Russia, including a list of more than 600 Russians banned from entering the country. One of the people to be banned from the entering Russia is joining us now. We are about to speak to Mayor Aaron Hawkins. Kia ora, Mayor, are you there?
Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for talking with us today. Just to start off, along with the other heads of municipal bodies, law enforcement agencies, and journalists, you have been banned from entering Russia. Is there a part of you that feels a sense of solidarity with your other banished co-workers and leaders for having identified as standing against the Kremlin's actions? Like, what are your feelings in the situation?
Yeah, it's important to note that we've not had any official correspondence with the Russian Foreign Ministry, so we have to try and guess as to why it may be that they're particularly sensitive about those of us who appeared on that list. The most obvious seems to be the position that many of us have taken, standing in solidarity, not with each other, but with people in Ukraine against the naked and unwarranted aggression of the Russian military. And so, you know, it's kind of funny in a way that a country as powerful as that would be concerned about what the mayor of Dunedin might think. but it's important not to lose sight of why we're having these sorts of discussions.
Yeah, definitely. And given those actions that you assume got you on this list, do you regret any of the decisions you made or things that led you to being involved or part of this ban?
No regrets. It is on my list of places to visit. It always had been. I've always been interested in Russia and would love to visit the State Hermitage Museum or Anton Chekhov's house or the Odessa Steps or any one of a number of sites of interest in our cultural and creative history. But my bucket list seems fairly trivial in comparison to what's going on in Eastern Europe at the moment. So absolutely no regrets for anything that we have done that might have aroused a suspicion. We've sent letters to local government in Eastern Europe, particularly those that we have relationships with through the UNESCO Creative Cities Network. So perhaps that is correspondence that has crossed the Russian Foreign Ministry's radar. We don't know. It is a shame not to have something on formal letterhead that we're able to get framed, but who knows, that may be still in the post.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And as well, did it come as a surprise because you, along with the other people who have been banned, have obviously been outspoken about and against the Kremlin's actions and very aware of the situation going on in Eastern Europe. But did it still come as a surprise that your name made it onto the list?
Did it come as a surprise? Yeah. I mean, I tend not to get up in the morning and expect to be banned from a foreign country. That isn't something that's ever happened to me and isn't something that happens to many people, I don't think. So yes, oddly, I was listening to on Sunday morning an old mix of DJ Vardin's, who's a Russian-born musician, and then was sent a link to the story in the news on Sunday morning. So yes, it was a surprise, and it's a fairly eclectic mix of individuals. It's quite a guest list that they've put together. It's certainly as close as I'll ever come, I think, to being considered in the same league as a Russian oligarch.
Well, I mean, I guess it's sort of an interesting experience to be put on this list that not many other people will be able to claim.
Yeah, and it'll be an insufferable story that I will bore people with for years to come, I'm sure.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on this morning and having a bit of a chat with us about this.
No worries.
Thank you very much. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
That was, of course, Mr. Mayor Aaron Hawkins, who is one of the 32 New Zealanders banned from entering Russia as of Sunday. It is coming close to the end of our show here on R1 News for Tuesday, the 2nd of August. So quickly, we're just going to dive through history for our last little segment on this day. As I just mentioned, today is the Ratu, Tuesday, the 2nd of August. So let's have a look at some things that have taken place on this day in previous years. Shall we?
Yes, we shall. Okay, starting off with the little sub-feature, Can You Believe? Can you believe that winter is almost over?
Wow.
I know, it's crazy. The three-month period with the least amount of available sunlight ends today, which is great news. I'm so excited. Compared to the shortest day of the year, which was the 21st of June, Dunedin and the rest of the South Island, the sun is now rising 24 minutes earlier and setting 33 minutes later, so we get a total of 57 extra minutes of sunlight. So, you know, wear your sun hats.
Better slip, slop, slap.
Yeah.
That number's only going to get bigger. Some other things that have happened on the 2nd of August, looking at New Zealand history in particular, in 1983 on this day, there was an anti-nuclear protest march in Auckland against the visit of an American nuclear power guided missile cruiser called Texas. Port visits by the United States warships had been controversial for many years coming up to this day, as it was an American policy to neither confirm nor deny the presence of nuclear warheads or other weapons on their vessels. Protests and rallies on this day 39 years ago took place on both land and sea and were very instrumental in the New Zealand nuclear-free movement at that time in the upcoming elections. Just a fun fact.
That is a fun fact.
And our last fun fact is quite a groovy one today.
Yes, it is.
On the 2nd of August, somebody quite famous legally changed their name. Do you know who Robert Allen Zimmerman is commonly known as?
Well, I do now, since we discussed this before we went on air. But before that, no, I did not.
Well, it was Bob Dylan on this day in 1962, legally became Bob Dylan, the name with which he is a world-famous musician, a major figure in popular culture, and has had a career spanning over 60 years. Bob Dylan is also not only a songmeister extraordinaire, but an author, drawer, and painter too. So that's some fun facts for the 2nd of August, and I feel like a great way to wrap up our show here on R1 News.
It has been a very eclectic show, but it has been good. It's been fun. We've had some great interviews. Yeah,
we started off talking local body politics with Professor Janine Haywood, and we're going to keep looking into that topic over the next few weeks before the election on October 8th.
After that, we spoke to PhD student Leon Sterkwing about the government's decision to fully reopen the borders to all levels of tourist visa holders and what it may do to affect the economy and tourism industry. After that, we were joined by Mayor Aaron Hawkins to talk about him being on the list of one of the 32 New Zealanders banned from entering Russia.
And that's been our show for Ratu Tuesday, the 2nd of August. You can tune into R1 News every weekday from 11 to 12 a.m. here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi, Radio 1, 91 FM.
We're going to leave you with a song. Make sure to stay tuned and stay locked. This is Mystery Waitress with Baby, Lake South Remix.
Thanks for listening to Radio 1 91 FM podcast. All of our content lives online at r1.co.nz.